Welcome to the 18th century, the Centurion, sponsored as always by Becky Navikatz, Leil Nishmas Yonah ben Reb Aryeh Leib. With each passing century, our subjects become more difficult to address because they're closer to us in time, and therefore there's more biographical material that's accessible to us. But by the same token, there's a tendency then to evaluate them based on contemporary standards and mores, and so we can lose their essence. Some people can only be approached with awe and a recognition that true understanding is beyond us. People whom we know personally, and people whose lives read like legends but are all true and real. Our centurion is unique in that he never held any public position, was not an official leader of the Jewish people or the Rav of a city or Rosh Yeshiva. He never published anything in his lifetime, but he was acknowledged as one of the greatest Jews in history, a throwback to ancient times, a man who towered over his generation and who influences us until today in a variety of ways. And I'm referring, of course, to Rav Elio Kramer, known to us as the Gaon Mivilna, or the Gra, Hagon Rabbeinu Eliyahu, or simply the Gaon. Since he lived, we've had Gaonflation in Jewish life. Everybody's a Gaon now. But if one refers simply to the Gaon, everyone knows that you're talking about the Gaon of Vilna. Interesting, he was known to his contemporaries as the Gaon, but he was usually called and referred to in writing by his contemporaries as Rabbi Eliyahu HaChosid, Rabbi Eliyahu the Pious One. Ironic, of course, in light of his later controversies. So not only was he a genius, but he was a paragon of chesed, of kindness, of Avas Yisrael, of personal piety that we don't ordinarily associate with the Gaon. He was a man who was devoted to Torah in all its aspects and in a way that's almost unimaginable today. It's really hard for us to wrap our minds around his genius. The Gaon was an expert in every area of Torah, but every area was clear to him. It was as if it was open and readable even without any books. He had a phenomenally organized mind, and he had an astounding photographic memory in which he just saw Kol HaTorah Kula before him at every point. It's hard for us to deal with that. We know, we hear there are savants and there are prodigies, there are people with photographic memories, and we try to more or less conform them to our expectations. We're talking about an individual that is far beyond our understanding to have that genius. I'll give you a story that's unrelated that just reminded me of a Gaon I saw a few months ago. There was a Jew named Rav Elia Kletzkin, who was the Rav of Lublin, came to live in Yerushalayim in the 20th century, and in the 1920s, living in Yerushalayim, tremendous genius in Talmud Chacham. And in the Old City, he heard Arabs over talking excitedly, angrily about something, and he was very suspicious, but he didn't understand Arabic. He was concerned. So what he did is he memorized all the sounds they were making, and he went and related them verbatim to a Sephardi who understood Arabic. He himself was aghast when he heard they were plotting a pogrom, and because of that, they were able to thwart the pogrom. Is it true? So Rabbi Wein always used to say that, you know, about us, they don't tell such stories, whether they're true or not. But what's frightening is that these stories are true. At least some of them are true. That type of genius is what we're talking about when we refer to the Gaon Mivilna and more. So what was his life and what is his influence? The Gaon Mivilna was born on the first day of Pesach in the year 1720 from very good stock. His father, Shlomo Zalman, sat and learned, and unusual for the time, he sat and learned and was supported by the community from a special fund that was set up earlier, generations earlier, by the Gaon's great-grandfather, Rav Moshe Rifkus. Rav Moshe Rifkus is known to us as the author of the Be'er HaGol on the Shulchan Aruch. But he had some money as well, and he willed that money to support Talmidei Chachamim in Vilna to learn. His granddaughter, Rav Moshe Rivka's granddaughter, married the son of Rav Moshe Kramer. Kramer, Yiddish for a shopkeeper, and that became the ancestors of the Gaon. The Gaon's mother, Trena, also had a story, also a famous story. As an infant, she was being carried by her mother, who tripped crossing a bridge and dropped her, the infant, into a raging river in the dead of winter. And she disappeared under the water, and somehow she floated up and floated on her pillow until she came to shore and was retrieved alive from the water. This girl grew up and married Rav Shlomo Zalman, and they were the parents of the Groh. The story continues that Rav Chaim Volozhin, when he would cross that bridge, he would always say the bracha, b'shemu malchus, she'osa li neis b'makom hazeh. God performed a miracle for me, because but for the fact the Gaon's mother was saved at that bridge, there'd be no Gaon, and Rav Chaim held there'd be no Rav Chaim either. Which he cites the halacha that a person can say this bracha if a nes happens to someone else, if that nes has a direct impact on his life. By the time the Gaon was three, and again, it's hard for us to put ourselves in this perspective, the Gaon had mastered all of Chumash by the time he was three, and soon after, all of Tanakh. So all this sounds very strange to our jaded ears and our pampered lives. I mean, I'm sure there's still people like this, but we don't know any of them. The truth is, in the introduction to my great-grandfather's last Sefer, someone wrote a biographical sketch, and it says that he had finished Baba Basra by the time he's four. Most of our children are barely walking when they're three. But the Gaon had finished Chumash by the time he was three. We're talking about different people. At age six, he gave his first public Talmudic discourse to an astonished group of Rabbonim. He was taught for 6 years by his father. I guess give him a break. Maybe the first year he didn't learn that much. But from ages 2 to 6, he was taught by his father. And then his father sent him to the town of Kaiten to learn with Rabbeinu Moshe, who was the author of the Pnei Moshe on the Yerushalmi. And he graduated from there at age 7. When the Groh was 7 years old, he had finished all of Shas. At age 8, he began studying Kabbalah and simultaneously astronomy, mathematics, and other sciences in which he's proficient. Now again, all of this sounds very strange to us, but the fact is there are people even today, you know, they enter college at the age of 9, these precocious, gifted children. We just don't come across too many of them. I saw last week in the paper that in New York City, they have a test every year that they run for gifted children, and they put in special programs in the public school, and thousands of parents come through and claiming that their children are gifted, which apparently is the role of the modern parent, but 80% are rejected immediately and 20% go to the next level. But in fact, the Gaon is what we call a gifted child. Also, already before he's age 10, he mastered Torah and science as well. Now in one sense, because of that, the Gaon was a role model for that part of Orthodoxy that's not only comfortable with secular knowledge, but perceives it as indispensable to a complete understanding of Torah. From another perspective, that became another controversy surrounding the Gaon. Exactly what did he learn and why did he learn it? Because we see, for example, that his father permitted him to study some aspect of medicine, but not pharmacology, claiming it would be too much of a distraction from Torah. The Gaon literally mastered every letter of Torah, and he saw patterns in the Torah that had never been seen before. And these become the famous comments of the Groh that people are wont to quote all the time, just ingenious elements of Torah. I mean, the Groh saw all of life in the Torah, not just the religious life. All of secular life, all of knowledge is found in the Torah, if one can only understand it properly. So, I'll give an example. The Groh says, the Torah says, sorry, the Gemara says that a Talmid Chacham should have just an eighth of pride. Shminis min hashminis. That's what the Gemara says, an eighth of an eighth, 1/64. What's the pshat? So the Gaon said, it's based on a pasuk. Katonti mikol hachasidim. Yaakov Avinu said, I've been made small. So if you say you've been made small, there's an element of pride to that. So the Gaon said, an eighth of an eighth. That's the eighth pasuk of the eighth parsha in the Torah. That's the reference in the Gemara. But the Gemara otherwise is without clear understanding. This pshat of the Gra is one of just thousands and thousands of similar insights that the Gra would have on every word, every letter, every pasuk of the Torah, and every line in the Gemara as well. The Gaon's sons wrote in the introduction to the Bir HaGra on the Shulchan Aruch that at age 13, he adopted the ascetic lifestyle that became his norm, and he devoted himself completely to the study of Torah. Completely. In line with the Gemara says in Brachos Daf Chesem and Aleph that Miyom Shechar Beis HaMikdash Ein Lo LaKadosh Baruch Hu Ba'olamo Ela Arba Amos Halacha Bavad. From the time of the Churban, all God really has in His world is the four Amos in Halacha. So they write the life of the Gra. We derive some of these stories of the life of the Gra from what his children wrote about him. This from the time he was 8, 9 years old, he never looked beyond his four Amos. Biyoso ben Teisha Shanim, Vahiyadov Ravlo, Bimikro, Bimishna, Bigmoro, Viyizba Misvaros Devrayan. He had already completely immersed himself by age of 9 in all of Shas, as well as deriving the Svaros of the Machlokes. It wasn't superficial. Gam Midrashagados, Samchos Acharayan, Ruach Midina Sohe, Kitsu Vitomarlo. Everything that he touched, every idea that he encountered, just became seeds for his very fertile mind. Lo histakel ad yom moso midalat amosov chutza. He never looked after that point beyond the four amos, so as not to have his own four amos, so as not to have any enjoyment, any pleasure from this world. He was not a this worldly person. So they write their father, from the time he was a child, never ate more than 2 kazesim of bread every day and water. That was his meal. And he became a master in every area of Torah. Before he was 20, the Gaon married a woman, Chana from Kaidan, where he learned earlier, and he lived there for a few years and completely immersed in Talmud Torah. He would often repair to a small hut in the middle of a forest so he could learn privately without any distractions at all, and his wife would bring him food. Now, we can't and should not sit in judgment for obvious reasons. Certainly his wife knew what to expect, and she saw her role as providing him with the means to sit and learn. So she fulfilled her task with love and enthusiasm, but it's impossible to translate that commitment into our understanding, into a modern context. They had 7 children. One daughter died shortly before her wedding. The 3 sons became great Rabbonim. The 3 daughters all married great Rabbonim. But suffice it to say, and the Gaon will be the first to say this, the children were raised by their mother and almost never by their father, who was basically not there for extended periods of time, and even when he was there, he was secluded. And yet, they write about their father with tremendous awe, with reverence, with love, with respect. Reb Chaim Volozhin writes about his Rebbe, Reb Chaim, the Gra, that you would think you're in the presence of an angel. So it could be when children sense this, so they look at the father a different way, that he really is different. They write again in the introduction to the Bir HaGra that he distanced himself. He distanced himself even from the company of his household, of his children. And they write, he never asked us, Be'esek parnasasamu mahus matzavam. He never asked, how are you? What, how you're earning a living? You have enough money for the family? He never asked any such thing. So we look at the Gra as the quintessential Kalta Litvak, and part of that is true, but it's so much more than that. During his travels, he would write letters constantly to the family. The letters never asked about them. The letters were always filled with Musar, with Torah. when one of his adult children would visit late in life, so his sons write, Gam ki higdila simcha, even if the joy was great, because they hadn't seen him in a year or two, he would not ask them about their children or their parnasa, but he would encourage them to make up in his home for their lost learning on the trip. So his sons write that his hasmada was superhuman. He never slept more than 2 hours in any 24-hour period, but he would sleep in four intervals of 30 minutes each, one interval by day and three during the night, after which he would immediately arise, his zgaber ka'ari, he would wash and he'd begin learning again. And even while sleeping, his son said, he'd be whispering halachos va'agados, as if unconsciously he was just emitting Torah constantly. He would learn Torah by candle, by daytime, to shut out distractions from the outside, and he would keep his feet in cold water, even in the winter through the night, to prevent himself from falling asleep. So he deprived himself of food and sleep, but that's how he became the Gaon. And you know the Gaon does write that this is not for everybody, that it works for him, but he didn't recommend it even to his Talmidim, nor did they seek to make it normative. I know people who sleep, 4 30-minute periods in a 1 hour time frame, so. But that's how he became the Gro. Famously, he wore talis and tefillin the entire day, including for mincha, one of the distinctive traits of the followers of the Gaon Mivilna. Now, the Gaon was supported by the fund that I mentioned earlier, that it was set up by his great-grandfather, the Be'er HaGolah, and then also by a stipend that was given to him by the Kohol in Vilna, even though he held no official position. But he towered over everyone, and he influenced everyone and everything in Vilna. If you think about it, it was undoubtedly very hard to be the Rav of Vilna, or to be a Dayan in Vilna, or to be even a Rosh Kohol in Vilna, when there was such a personality as the Gaon there. In his mid-20s, the Gaon went into exile alone for several years, traveling through Europe, mostly incognito. Why he did that is unknown. The speculations are that he wanted to endure exile as a punishment for his sins. He wanted to meet and learn Torah with other Jews and extract from elsewhere in Europe the Talmidei Chachamim that he thought would be able to enlighten the Jewish world. A very cogent reason was that he wanted to visit the major libraries of Europe, including Berlin, that contained ancient manuscripts of the Talmud Bavli, of the Rishalmi, of the Rishonim, something that became a major focus of the Gra, to ascertain the exact text of the entire Torah Shebaal Peh, Talmud and Midrashim and the Siddur. And this became really a major effort of the Gaon, in which of course his phenomenal memory played a role. He would see a manuscript and he would know immediately that it differed by a word with what he had learned previously. He didn't have to schlep any Svarim with him or the Bar Ilan Sidi Ram. He was the Bar Ilan Sidi Ram. Now, there were several consequences of his years in exile. First, his reputation as a genius became renowned. It was not possible to hide it, and in town after town, he was exposed. People had heard of him. They knew of someone, Reb Elio HaChassid of Vilna, but they didn't know him. They, remember, we're 18th century, there was no photography, they didn't know what he looked like, but Rabbonim immediately were overcome by his presence and his greatness. By the time his exile had finished and he'd returned to Vilna, so he was revered across the Jewish world. He also investigated and clarified many faulty texts that he found in the Talmud, in the Midrashim, in the Rishonim as well. He never emended a text based on his own svara. I mean, some didn't make sense, and therefore he would change it to conform it to what would make sense. Only if he had documentary proof that something was a mistake, then he would change it. That became a famous Hagos Hagro on the Shas. He was even able to show, in many cases, how the errors crept in, how the copyist made a mistake, usually by writing, and the original copyist writing an abbreviation that was later misconstrued by another copyist for some other abbreviation that the original one did not have in mind. And often the halacha was different based on the change in the text, and the Gra undertook as well a systematic review of the manuscripts of the Rishonim, and he showed where the printer's error had changed their meanings as well. Lest we think that this was done lightly or freely, as became the case with the many scientific scholars of Judaism, Reb Chaim writes that the Gra would do tshuva and fast each time he felt it necessary to make even one change. When he returned to Vilna in his late 20s, he resumed his learning, but he was compelled to take a more public role simply by virtue of his greatness. He never held any official position, nor did he lead a yeshiva, but from the age of 40 and on, he taught in his Beis Medrash to select disciples. He also became very famous for his piety, so you shouldn't think that he was a loner. He was called, as I noted before, by his contemporaries, Reb Eliyahu HaChassid, so it wasn't just personal piety, although the Gra was meticulous in his Shmiras HaMitzvos, incorporating numerous chumros and minority opinions, although not forcing them on others, but it was the way he treated others, the poor, the widow, the orphan. He would freely give away to the poor the stipend that he received from Vilna. He would even give away household vessels to the consternation and note that irritation of his wife. Sometimes giving away money left his own family without money. One story is when they ran out, he told his children to go to their friends around dinner time and they'll be taken in then. Part of what happened for a number of years is that the shamus in Vilna, who was in charge of providing the Gaon his stipend, started stealing it, knowing that the Gaon would not say anything. And in fact, the Gaon said nothing for years so as not to embarrass him. His family struggled, but the Gra lived in a different reality altogether. His sons write that because of his genius and his dedication in Avodas Hashem, he was able to remove every worry from his heart. Lavodas Hashem b'simcha u'betuv lev kol hayomim, to serve God with joy and a good heart all the days. Whatever he did with das kono. He felt this is what the Creator wanted of him. And he really was unique in that he was completely uninterested in whatever Olam Hazeh had to offer. The Gra published nothing in his lifetime, but he wrote voluminously, always taking notes, whatever sefer he was learning. One of his disciples, Rabbi Yisrael of Shklov, records in the introduction to the Pa'as HaShulchan that the Gaon wrote 70 svarim, of which 30 itself were on Kabbalah, the Zohar, Tikkuni Zohar, the various other svarim of the Zohar. The Gra famously said that he would not be embarrassed to share his chidushim with Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. Famously, firstly, his commentary was published on Mishlei, which of course is extant, beautiful insights into human nature, psychology, and to the creation of perfected personality, on the Megillos, on Agadah, the Bir HaGra, on all of Shulchan Aruch, where the Gra traces every halacha in the Shulchan Aruch back to the Bavli or Yerushalmi, or sometimes the Rishonim, on Chumash, on Hebrew grammar. He wrote a commentary, many mesechtos also, some of which were lost. About 20 of the svarim no longer extant. In short, there was no area of Torah on which the Gaon did not write. And he also wrote about the sciences he'd studied, about astronomy and mathematics, algebra, medicine. Whatever he was involved in, he had a desire, he had an incisive mind, a very penetrating mind, tremendously analytical and rational mind, and he was able to solve numerous problems, not only in the world of Torah, but outside the world of Torah as well. So most of his works were from the Gaon's own manuscripts, and were published sequentially by his sons and sons-in-law in the years after his death. Everything was edited, and then by others for another 60 years. It was close to the end of the 19th century by the time all the works of the Gaon that remained extant were published. The fact that his children engaged in this as their lifelong work is itself a testament to the feelings that they had for their father. To this day, every year you find Sfarim of the Gra are constantly published, usually now compilations or encyclopedias in one form or another. Some writers say for a certain theme, and he will compile what the Gaon said in any of the other 50 works on that particular theme. So the depth and the breadth is beyond the scope of the normal human beings. Again, of the 50 Svarim drafted by the Gra, of the 70 drafted by the Gra rather, about 50 are in print, and they're all written in the Gra's very terse and very sparing style. He was no Dickens. He was very, very precise, very tight with his language, and so to study the Gra is not to read the Gra, but is to study the Gra. I mentioned the Gra was well-versed in every area of general studies as well, all because he felt that it sheds light on the Torah itself. So he studied music in depth. Remember, Bach and Mozart were contemporaries, not that he knew them. But he studied music, he writes, in order to understand the Shiri Halevian and the Avod in the Beis HaMikdash, the roles of instrumental music in the Beis HaMikdash. And he allegedly said that a person who does not understand music cannot fully grasp Kavana. We'll never understand what Kavana is, because music has a way of penetrating to a different part of the human personality and just enabling us to hone in on a connection that otherwise might not be there. He also commissioned the translation of the books of Josephus Flavius, because he said that you can deduce valuable information about the Beis HaMikdash from his works. He was an eyewitness, after all. And his student, Rav Baruch of Shklov, wrote a translation from the Greek of Euclid's Geometry, which the Gaon held also was very important to understand. Now, it was Rav Baruch of Shklov who writes in his introduction to that translation of Euclid's work that the Gra said, and I quote, it's a famous quote, "To the extent that a person is lacking in wisdom and secular knowledge, he'll be lacking a hundredfold in the wisdom of Torah." You have to understand the Torah, you need to have familiarity with so many areas of general knowledge. Now, that obviously is a red flag to many people today. One biographer of the Gra claims that the Gra, the Rav Baruch, was only briefly a Talmud of the Gra, and he really misunderstood the Gra's intent. Who knows? Part of the mystique of the Gaon is that he was somewhat inscrutable, and he was so singular, so exceptional in his generation. So the modern Orthodox see the Gra as the paragon of Torah Mada, and the Yeshiva world see the Gra as the paragon of Torah alone, Torah Lishma. The truth is probably both, with this caveat. Clearly, the Gra did not see any value in secular knowledge for its own sake, but only as a handmaiden to Torah. But not to utilize that handmaiden creates a very stark deficiency in one's knowledge of Torah. The most famous of the Gra's works, published posthumously, is probably his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, but undoubtedly the most widely used and the most influential is entitled simply Maisei Rav, What the Rav Did. It's a compilation of the Gaon's practices and minhagim that gained the following among his disciples and their descendants, and down to our day, many through the Brisker tradition and the Rav Soloveitchik and others. It's been reprinted many times. It's always augmented. So my copy is called Maisei Rav HaShalem. Distinguish it from the others that didn't have everything the Gra wanted to teach us. But the Gra had many, many different practices that have come down. There are people even here observe some of them. Some observe all of them. The Gra, for example, just to take these at random, the Gra used only two matzahs at the Seder, like the Rambam says. The Gra banned flowers in shul on Shavuos. It's Chukos Ha'akum. He dropped the Yishalol in Kaddish, Yisborech, after Yehesh Me'rabah, so it wasn't part of the original text. said Bonei Yerushalayim in the Birchas HaMazon, not Barachamav. It's the pasuk of Bonei Yerushalayim Hashem. He first made the bracha and then washed his hands, not like the common minhag is. When he washed before davening, we say a bracha al Nitzias Adayim as well. He changed the order of the Torah reading on Rosh Chodesh. He would only hold the front two tzitzis for Kriyat Shema, not all four. And he would not kiss them at all. He would not say Nekadesh. That's what the Shat says, Nekadesh. Let us sanctify God. The Shat, according to the Gra, does not say Elokeinu, like I was saying before Duchening. Rather, right after the bracha ends, the Chana Ados, someone in the audience yells out, Kanim, and on and on and on. Interestingly, the Gon did not wear tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam, because just Rashi's tefillin, because he said if we want to account for every machlokas, then we would need 64 pairs of tefillin, not just two. And he also ruled that the minimum shir for tzedakah is 20% of a person's income, not 10%, as others thought. Whatever he did, and by the way, these things are in the thousands, whatever he did for one purpose, not reward, not olam haba, but simply lishma, simply to serve God, period. Famous story, the residents of Vilna would vie with each other every year to buy the Gra an Esrog, the most beautiful Esrog they could find. One year was great difficulty, and finally found a beautiful Esrog, Mudar, that the owner refused to sell. And then when he was told, it was a distant village, when he was told it's for the Gra, he said he'll give it to the Gra on one condition, that the Gra transferred to him the schar in Olam Haba that he would get for that mitzvah. So his Talmidim were trepidatious to approach the Gra with such a strange request. When the Gra was told, he rejoiced. He said, finally, a pure mitzvah, no ulterior motive, just to do the mitzvah kachtam lachem, without any expectation of anything else. The Gra's practices have influenced long beyond his lifetime. It's beyond doubt, but unprovable, that the Gra was moved by forces that do not intrude on mere mortals, both in his brilliance and his personal character, and especially his life decisions. One of them, in his late 40s, the Gra decided to uproot himself and make aliyah. He'd actually traveled away from his home, and then he sent a letter to his family saying that he's heading on to Israel and they shouldn't worry about him. Now again, to some of us it might sound strange. We don't understand the milieu of the Gra, nor do we really understand his greatness, but he writes, we have the Igeres HaGra and other Sforim that were published. Basi levakesh meidchem shlo tzitzaru klal klal. I ask you not to be worried at all. Kama sheftichu li amitis v'gam lo tidenu. Sheftichu li imitichyeh v'gam lo tidagu. Don't be aggrieved and don't be worried about me. Hinei anashim nosim al kama shenim b'shvil mamon. People travel sometimes for years just in pursuit of money. Minichim nishaseihem, they leave their wives, v'gam heim nova nod b'choser kol, and they wander about without any means, just with privations. V'ani tadol akel, I thanks to God, nosei lo eretz hakadoshah, I'm traveling to the Holy Land. Shakom mitzapim leros, everybody yearns to see it. Chemdas kol Yisrael, the chemdas Hashem Yisbarach, kohol yonim atachim tshukasom eleho. V'ani nosei b'shalom baruch. That's the letter he sent. This goes on for a few pages. And he tells his wife that she has money that's set aside. Don't skimp on the children's education, whether the boys or the girls. He advised his children to avoid sicha b'teila, idle conversation, as the worst of sins, even telling his daughters not to go to shul. If there's a fear that when they go to shul, they might succumb to idle talk or to jealousy. And he says other things as well. His mother was still alive also. He's prepared told his wife to take care of her too. He left Vilna traveling through Germany, and he never made it. His trip was aborted. The unsolved mystery is why he never made it to Eretz Yisrael. His sons write again in Hakdama to the Bir Agra that they asked him repeatedly, and he refused to answer. And then he finally said to them, "Ein li rishus min hashamayim. I have no permission from heaven to go." Interestingly, they write, he gave the same answer when they asked him, he had said he wants to write a synopsis of the Shulchan Aruch, just Piskei Halacha, in a very clear, concise, lucid form. So just know, without having any discussions, this is what to do. He didn't. Asked why, he said again, "Ein li rishus min hashamayim. I have no permission from heaven to do it." The latter might be a little more understandable, because it was felt if he did that, he would undo the works of many others and act as if his word is the final word, which we never have in Torah, but he didn't. As for the former, his wish was partially fulfilled, and the Gaon preached constantly and inculcated in his Talmidim the desire and the need to make Aliyah. And beginning in 1808, some of his Talmidim did make Aliyah, beginning with Menachem Mendel of Shklov, and then others as well. These Talmidim of the Gruff first lived in Tveria, where they clashed with the Hasidim of the Maggid of Mezrich. They moved to Tzvat, found common company with the Sfardim who lived there. Then they moved to Yerushalayim with this historic significance. They became the Ashkenazi community in Yerushalayim known as the Prushim, because they separated themselves from the community. But they bolstered the population so that Jews, contrary to the mythology, were already the majority in Yerushalayim in 1840, 20 years before Herzl was even born. His Talmidim also established, therefore, the Minhagim of the Gra as the Ashkenazi custom in Israel. And therefore, for example, they don't say Baruch Hashem Olam Amen V'Amen after Ma'ariv. And in fact, they regularly, when they duchen every day, they have some from the audience. The Gabbai yells out, Kohanim. All these things are based on the Minhagim of the Gra. They were there first as the Ashkenazim, so they were Koveh, the Minhagim, for everyone, all the Ashkenazim. The Gaon was such a dominant intellectual force that inevitably he became a public figure and leader despite having no official position. Vilna had a Rav, Vilna had an Av Beis Din. The Gaon always declined, even when he was offered the position. But he became involved in national issues. For example, he intervened and tried to defend both Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz and the Ramchal, Ramash Chaim Lutzato, against charges of Rabbi Yaakov Emdin, that both were closet followers of Shabtai Tzvi. And although they never met, the Gaon was enamored with the Ramchal, loved the Mesilas Yesharim, which came out during his lifetime, and he said he even committed it to memory. The Gaon was drawn into a major controversy involving the Rav of Vilna, of Shmuel ben Avigdor, who was officially dismissed from his position in the late 1770s, for the official charge was not learning Torah sufficiently, which I guess compared to the Gra was likely true. But unofficially, the reason was he was appointing relatives to communal positions. The controversy is very acrimonious. The Gaon supported the Kahal that had dismissed the Rav. It made its way into the secular courts and the Lithuanian political system, and the Gra was even imprisoned for a time. This dispute raged again a few years later. Eventually, Shmuel ben Avigdor left, but Vilna did not again have a Rav until the 20th century. The Gaon was imprisoned a second time, involving his efforts to save a Jew, retrieve a Jew who had converted to Christianity. That second arrest apparently halted another initiative of the Gra, that's to restore Birchas Kohanim on a daily basis. He maintained Sali Mutter Berchiev, Kos Levarchos Ben Eishon Nalim Jarek Yisrael, it's a mitzvah in the exile as well, but he was prevented. The night before it was to start, he was arrested for this case, and the Gaon saw that as an omen. The major controversy of the Gaon's life, of course, was with the Nassim Hasidic movement, also with great repercussions until today. It's not hard to figure out why they clashed. There was a fear that anything different that had a mystical edge to it was somehow related to Shabtai Tzvi. Hasidic movement arose about a half century after the Shabtai Tzvi debacle. And for that matter, anything different, period, was always suspect. The Gra's essence was Talmud Torah, And the Hasidim de-emphasized Talmud Torah. They preferred tefillah, preferred developing an emotional bond with God over the intellectual rigors and discipline of Talmud Torah. The Hasidim emphasized joy, derived if necessary from smoking, from drinking, from singing, from dancing. The early Hasidic movement, you had people even doing handstands and cartwheels in shul in front of the Aron HaKodesh to show their joy. They would shout during the davening. All these things were weird to the Gra and his followers, but more they tasted of the heretical. And the Hasidim also were a separatist movement. Keep in mind, they adopted the Nusach HaAri, and therefore they started making their own shuls, own shtibels, own minyanim. Hasidism caught on, though, because most Jews were not on the level to serve God through Talmud Torah. The Vilna became the center of the Misnagdim. They were simply defined as opponents. They closed, the official kahal closed, or the shuls of the Hasidim. They were first put in Cheirim by the Gra in 1772. Then in 1777 it became almost a regular thing to put in Cheirim. The Gaon never met the Baal Shem Tov, but he also never met the Baal HaTanya. The Baal HaTanya came to Vilna, traveled to Vilna to meet the Gaon, and the Gaon refused to see him. And he maintained, the Alter Rebbe, that of Lubavitch, that he always had a great respect for the Gra, and he said that had the Gra met him, he would have allayed all his fears. Maybe yes, maybe no. The truth is the Hasidim emphasized kavana over everything, the service of the heart over everything. So for example, one did not daven until one was ready to daven. You needed to get into it. There's such a thing as zmanei tefillah. It didn't matter. What the heart wanted mattered more. Reb Chaim Volozhin Makdis in the Nefesh HaChaim. Nefesh HaChaim is written as an antidote to the Tanya. And there he says that to rely on kavana means that a person might wait to blow shofar on Pesach and eat matzah in the sukkah, because that feels good to him. The Maisei HaMitzvah Bizmano is paramount. And that became the hallmark of Lithuanian Jewry. Other deviations as well. The Hasidim introduced a new, sharper knife, the Shechita. The Gaon held was too thin. Another irony, today we say, oh, does it have Hasidic Shechita? In the Gaon's day, Hasidic Shechita was treif. They wouldn't eat it. They did not eat in the Sukkah Shemini Atzeres, with the Besht asserting, the Baal Shem Tov asserting that he lived in Eretz Yisrael type existence. By contrast, the Gra had his deathbed moved into the Sukkah. He should sleep there on Sukkahs. And through their activities, the Hasidim, they were denying the authority of the rabbis. And most troubling, establishing the Tzaddik as their intermediary to God, all of which was anathema to Jews and to the Gra. The Gra never relented, and the secular authorities often had to intervene. The activists on both sides made it even worse. Rabbanim on both sides were informed on and imprisoned on trumped up charges. Hasidim would occasionally circulate outside of Vilna, forged letters from the Gra claiming he had relaxed his opposition. It was a terrible time. And when the Gra died and the Hasidim in Vilna celebrated, so there were fights and arrests. What ended the feud really was the Haskalah, the Enlightenment, when both sides realized that whatever differences they had more in common, and they had a common enemy as well that might destroy all of Klal Yisrael. The Gra died on the 19th of Tishrei, Chol HaMoed Sukkos, in 1797, also happens to be my grandmother's yahrzeit, and he died in his sukkah. He had just been brought the Dalet Minim. He made the brach and held on to them, and then he clutched his tzitzis. In a very famous story, he said in praise of the tzitzis, "What a world we live in. For a few kopecks, a person can fulfill such a mitzvah. It's so cheap, so inexpensive, and we can commune with God through that mitzvah." He was buried in Vilna in the Schnippeshock Cemetery. The Gra was disinterred after World War II, when the Soviets decided to turn that ancient Jewish cemetery into a housing development. So Jews of Vilna, in the late 1940s now, were allowed to move seven graves. And they moved seven graves from that ancient cemetery to the Saltanishku Cemetery. The Gros was chosen, and those in his immediate vicinity were distant relatives and the famous Gerd Sedek of Vilna, Count Patatsky, who had been counseled by the Gros before he was executed by the authorities for his conversion. The story is that the Gros's body had not decomposed, that even the hairs on his beard were still intact as the Chevra laid him to rest in the new cemetery. It's fair to say that, in fact, the Tzemach Tzedek, the third Rebbe of Babich, did say it, that the Gros saved Hasidus. See, what are his legacies? He saved Hasidus. He challenged it during his lifetime, but for the Gaon's principled opposition, Hasidus might have remained the province of drinkers and acrobats. But he restored the primacy of Torah and reduced some of the rough edges, so that the 19th century Hasidic Rebbeim were often noted for their Torah knowledge, whereas in the earlier times it was trivialized. Today, of course, there's still vestiges of the initial dispute between the Hasidim and Misnagdim, but mainly in jokes, and occasionally beneath the surface as well. Secondly, the Minhagim of the Gros dominate part of Jewish life, like the Minhagim of the Ari do in another part, and the Gros influence on life in Israel is profound, even to religious life in Israel, as the Nusach Ashkenaz largely incorporates the customs of the Gros, and of course many Jews still daven what's called the Nusach HaGros. In terms of Talmud Torah, the Gaon ensured the primacy of Talmud Torah in Jewish life through the power of his own example and through his students as well. In the 1790s, his disciple Reb Chaim of Volozhin enthusiastically asked the Gros for permission to start the first formal yeshiva in Volozhin, formal yeshiva. Curriculum, dorm, fundraisers, the Gros said nothing, and Reb Chaim desisted. 2 years later, Reb Chaim came back and asked the Gros again in a more subdued tone, and the Gros consented. Asked to explain, so the Gros said, "When you first came, I sensed there was too much personal pride involved, that it wasn't purely l'shem shemayim, and such an endeavor would not succeed. Now I see it properly motivated, then it will succeed." And of course, Volozhin became the Eim HaYeshivot in Eastern Europe, elevated Talmud Torah to the desert Aradim of Jewish life, spawned a whole new generation, generations of Talmidei Chachamim, and even indirectly the Musar movement that developed in the yeshiva world as well. Finally, in terms of secular knowledge, for sure, the Gros incorporation of secular knowledge has left both sides, pro and con, claiming his legacy. Clearly, though, ignorance is not bliss. The Gros, in his greatness, must remain an enigma to us mortals. In a very famous tale, which shows you the enigmatic nature of his life, the Gros regularly invited the Dubna Magid to give him Musar. And the Magid, as the story goes, thought, well, what can he possibly say to the Gros? The guy's a tzaddik, he's a chassid, he's a Talmud Chacham, the ranks with the Rishonim. So he said to the Gros, "You're the great Gaon, but you're a Gaon, you sit in your room and learn the whole day. Do you think you'd be the Gaon if you were like other Jews, had to work for a living, had to go to the market, had to interact with others?" Hasidim say the Gros heard this and broke down in tears. Misnagdim say the Gros shrugged and brushed it off, said it doesn't mean anything to him. That's part of the mysterious majesty of the Chassid of Vilna, Hagaon Rabbeinu Eliyahu. I thank you all very much.